Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, good morning. I'm David Gorin. I'm a freelance writer for a couple of organizations and media titles. And I'm talking today to Professor Don Ross, who is the methodology director for the Center for the Economic Analysis of Risk, which is attached to University College in Cork, UCT in Cape Town, and Georgia State University. Don, pleasure to see you again. I must first of all congratulate you on an astonishing book. We're going to be discussing a book called The Gambling Animal, co-authored by Don, together with his CEO at the Center for Economic Analysis of Risk, Glenn Harrison. The subtitle of the book is Humanity's Evolutionary Winning Streak and How We Risk It All. And I think straight away from the title of the book and the subtitle, we can certainly ascertain it's a very complicated book with myriad strains and themes. Don, if I can just dive straight in, I mean, because it's such an extraordinarily varied book, I found it quite, not only absorbing, but quite intricate to read. And I guess we're probably going to touch on no more than a third, if that, of the themes and the threads of the book in this discussion today. But as a starting point, I'd suggest that maybe because you're an economist primarily, maybe we should discuss why behavioral economics involves so many complex webs and themes and issues and threads of human behavior and history, et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps for the PageCast listeners, you could explain why that's the case.
Sure. Well, you know, what gives the discipline of economics its unity is that what economics is ultimately about is how people, or indeed other animals, any agents, respond to changes, shifts in incentives. So it's really about the way that agents interact with their environment, because incentives come from the environment. So that's what makes something economics is that we use a certain kind of mathematics and statistics to model that stuff. Notice that that gives us a very, very wide scope of phenomena that are open to us to study. Since what it really is to be an agent is to be responsive to incentives, right? What makes a person or an elephant or a fish an agent? What makes a corporation an agent, but not a rock? Well, the difference is you can't incentivize a rock to do anything, right? But you can incentivize a person, and you can incentivize an elephant, and you can incentivize a fish, and you can incentivize a corporation. So they're all objects of economic modeling. But then, of course, when we model them, we are, of course, interested in zoning in focusing on that risk response or that incentive response function. But we have to, they're embedded, of course, their behavior is embedded in a whole complex array of things, and we have to take account of those things. So therefore, we have to know a lot about the environment, and we have to know a lot about the agent. And that implicates us in issues in psychology and neuroscience and ecology and so on. So to be, Keynes once said, right, that to be an economist, you kind of have to be an expert on everything.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think to your credit, you are. In fact, that's one of the things that comes out a lot in the book is, you know, although I think there's just eight chapters, am I right? Yeah, eight chapters on the coda. It weaves around so many areas of Can I specify a few? Evolutionary science. That was, to me, quite fascinating. And I mean, if I can just pause on that one. I mean, I was astonished to read that as recent as 50,000 years ago, there were only, if I remember the statistic, Don, 20,000 Homo sapiens on planet Earth, and there were over 100 million elephants.
That's right.
Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, correct.
And where you spin from that is that, you know, civilization as such, it was a bit of a, and here we come to the aspect of gambling or risk. It was a bit of a toss-up as to whether civilization was started by humans or elephants. And of course, you unpack that to a degree, and you say, well, it's unlikely that elephants could have started or would have started civilization, but it's not totally improbable. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the most important thing we want to get across with that little bit, is that we do think it would have been unlike if we, well, first let's say this, if we had, elephants could not possibly develop civilization given that we did. There isn't room on this planet for two civilizations, which imply considerable population increase by two very resource-hungry big species. So we blocked any possibility that anybody else was going to do this. But the key point we want to make when we speculate about the prospects or the probability that elephants might have been able to develop civilization if we had not, the key point we want to make there is the reason we think they probably would not have isn't because we don't think they're smart enough. It isn't because they lack the brain power. It's rather for the rather special reason that they're not under any incentives to store information in the environment the way we do. That is, elephants can get by pretty much with the daily flow of information that they pass between them, and they're not under any pressure to leave a record. But that is, of course, crucial to the development of science, and science is crucial to the development of and markets, and those are crucial to the development of civilization.
Yes, and imagination as well. I think that's another thing that I was quite struck with in the book, is how the human brain, for many flaws that we have, including a shocking memory, in contrast to elephants, the human brain is wired for imagination. And so we're able to even if we don't really consciously know what we evaluating, we're able to envisage different aspects of can we call it fantasy?
Yeah, and that's why we think it's very useful to compare humans with elephants. You can learn a lot about humans by comparing them with another species that is interestingly similar in a lot of ways, but also very crucially different in some ways. And one of the big differences is though both humans and elephants have very, very expensive brains, the parts of our brains that are exaggerated relative to other animals are different. Humans have a very densely packed frontal cortex. Elephants have a very, very densely packed cerebellum. Those brain areas work in slightly different, somewhat different ways. And the long and short of it, the consequence of that is that humans cope with a complex environment by modeling it. That is, we make hypotheses using our frontal cortical machinery about what is going on, and we update those estimates as we go, but we're basically always working to a conjecture about what we think the world is like. Of course, the other way you can cope with a complex world is just remember what happened really closely, and that's what elephants do as a result of the different structure of their brain. So it's two different strategies. All brains, the whole reason any brains ever evolved is to cope with complexity. That's why there are brains in the world. And the special kind of complexity our ancestors faced during our period of our formation in the Pleistocene, and the kind of brain that elephants evolved in a little bit earlier than us, but more or less in the same conditions and time, the special challenges of complexity that produced those two kinds of very expensive brains were just handled in different ways by us and them. And from that, a whole lot else follows.
Yes. Yeah. So you've touched upon something that's perhaps one of the more complex aspects of the book for, can we call them, lay readers like people like me. And that's the idea of or the methods involved in Bayesian economic theory or Bayesian theory and statistics, of course. And I think it's just, if you don't mind, Don, just very briefly, if you can explain to PageCast listeners the importance of Bayesian modeling in how we think, and of course to what you do as well as a modeler of risk.
Great, y'all. So let me just reassure listeners that the book does not require you to read any statistics. We put a little introduction to Bayesianism in an appendix, but we try to make sure the whole book, there isn't math in the book. Certainly the Bayesian theme is very important. Bayesian reasoning, we are convinced, along with increasingly many scientists and economists, is the most powerful and appropriate kind of inference machine you should use when you're trying to develop theories and models and confirm them and test them. And Bayesianism has been around for a long time, but it's really just come into its heyday in the late 20th century, and now its power wasn't completely fully under, it's only been gradually completely and fully understood. But I think pretty much everybody grasps it now, including, I should add, investment experts and fund managers in the bank. Now, the basic idea of a Bayesian reasoning or Bayesian modeling is pretty straightforward. It's that you begin with a bunch of subjective expectations about which variables in the world are related to which other variables and how. And that can be boiled down to a bunch of statistical distributions you think obtain over events and relations between events and things and processes. And then you make observations. That's something called Bayes' rule. It's just the rule that tells you how you should update those prior expectations you have as new observations come in.
Right.
Bayes' rule leaves you with a lot of scope, leaves people with quite a lot of scope. For example, if you're very risk averse, if you're afraid of risk, then you should update more conservatively. If you're risk prone, if you enjoy risk, then you update less conservatively as evidence comes in. And there's nothing rational or irrational about your risk preference, right? Economists don't say this is the risk preference everybody ought to have. People have the risk preferences they do, just like they have the preferences for ice cream that they do, right? It's not more rational to prefer chocolate. So Bayesian statistics is just the basic modeling of how people update. Scientists, of course, make heavy use of it because, in effect, when you're developing a scientific model, you've got a prior set of expectations, some theory, and then you make observations. And on the basis of those observations, you adjust your theory. That's Bayesian reasoning. Right. The last important point to make is the mammal brain, so this applies to us and elephants, but also cats and dogs and mice, the mammal brain implements a kind of quasi-Bayesian process. It's actually evolved to be Bayesian, but the Bayesian element of our brains is below our awareness. So somebody can be Bayesian at one level and not Bayesian at another level, right? Suppose we're all going to be Bayesian whether we like it or not at the level of our brains. But somebody might disregard Bayesian modeling and use another kind of modeling when they're thinking explicitly about the world, right? When they're thinking, when they're deliberating consciously, they might not use the Bayesian model. So we never get completely away from Bayesianism, but a truly consistent modeler uses their mind the same way their brain works, and that's Bayesian.
Yeah, exactly. Where this all sort of ties together ultimately, and we're jumping fast forward now to the last chapter of the book, which, if I remember correctly, is called Have We Gambled Away Our House? And I mean, to me, that was an expertly sort of climactic, if I can use that pun word, in the sense that you address directly the threat of climate change on all sorts of implications for not only human beings, but also, you know, the entire planet, of course, our fellow species. And I think it's fair to say that your point in that last chapter is that we risk gambling away where we are as a species, as a planet, as a society, as a civilization, because we don't properly understand all these decisions that we should be making collectively. We don't properly make them collectively. Our ability to coordinate a response is shambolic. And Donya, I was quite blown away by your example of how we handled as a global society the COVID epidemic, because I think your point there was that that's actually quite a simple example of what needed to be done, and we failed in near catastrophic terms. I think 21 or 22 million people died, and yet we have this far greater climate challenge upon us. So I guess, it's a rambling way of saying, do you think that the world is, leaders, all of us are properly applying Bayesian thinking to this climate challenge that we have?
So a few points about climate change. I mean, one point that I think is important to make is that extreme optimism to the effect that through willpower and leadership, we will somehow develop some general policy response at global scale. I think there's no basis for thinking that's even possible. And I don't think it ever was possible. It's not that we dropped a ball, as it were, sometime in the 80s or 90s. It wasn't that what the issue was never soluble in that way. on the other hand, right, we don't go so far with pessimists as to think that climate change actually threatens us with extinction. Human beings are highly adaptable, highly resilient, thanks to their imaginations and their ability to do technology and science. And so although climate change is likely to make very large parts of the world physically uninhabitable by people, including most of the continent of Africa, although it probably does threaten civilization, collapse of our current way of organizing industrial civilization, which depends on scale. So as that scale fall becomes unmanageable, our civilization will also become unmanageable. On the other hand, there are going to be parts of the world that remain habitable. People are going to remain in those parts of the world. They're going to still have records of science and technology, and we'll go on. It's not so clear that elephants will be so fortunate, right? When Africa becomes uninhabitable for people, it will also become uninhabitable for elephants. And although some elephants may survive in zoos, there won't be any more elephant society, since elephant society can't really operate in captivity. Let me just add to one of the most important things in what I just said is my point about why we can't expect and should never have expected a single coordinated magic policy solution at global scale. That requires finding solutions to so many different coordination problems in different places with involving different people that it defeats even theoretical modeling, let alone practical politics and practical organization. That is not something that can be done. And I have some sympathy with some political leaders who have, I mean, many of them, of course, have been captured by the fossil fuel industry, and there's been lots of corruption and lots of self-dealing and bad behavior among politicians. But there are also, as with everything else, some sincere, well-meaning, devoted politicians who applied their mind to this problem. But none of them have really achieved much success, and I sympathize with those who have tried hard and not made much progress.
Don, on that note, do you or the Center for the Economic Analysis of Risk currently advise quite a few governments on various policies?
We do policy analysis, but we're not currently directly working on climate change. My co-author, Glenn Harrison, had some direct climate change-related consultancies a number of years ago. My own consulting has concentrated on a quite different area. I've been mainly focusing on rural transportation in South Africa recently, and in the past I did some consulting on intellectual property and also on our fruit exports. But yeah, so climate change, we're not climate change policymakers.
Right. Okay, so now I'd like to veer quite significantly off track, although it's not really off track, because I was fascinated to hear as well that you are one of the early theoretical students of large language models, in other words, as a forerunner to AI. That was where your initial career moves were, student moves were, weren't they, Don?
Yeah, so my PhD was on an application of connectionist theory to language learning. That word connectionist I just used may be unfamiliar to many listeners, but connectionism is the name of the particular style of computational learning and modeling that is at the basis of the current LLM technology. Mm. And those fundamental theoretical breakthroughs that are facilitating the current wave of AI, those are the breakthroughs that were made when I was young and working on my PhD in the late 1980s. So they go back quite a way. The reason it took so long for that theory to have the big impact that we're seeing now is because the theory had got way out ahead of two things. It had got out ahead of the engineering capacity. These models, in order to work at scale, have to be very, very large. And we just couldn't, it was not possible in the 1980s and 90s to build machines that with that capacity that would be less than a football field in size. One machine was actually built in America, and it was the size of a football field. So it wasn't practical technology for that reason. Then also, these models are very, very data hungry. Before the internet, there was no way to get enough data to train it, not at scale. I trained the model that I built for my thesis by just leaving it, by leaving a voice recorder on all day, every day in a lab, So it was getting lots and lots of data, but from only a very small and weird set of people, right? It wasn't getting the kind of broad data that an LLM needs. So we had to wait for increasing miniaturization and speed of computing, which we eventually, of course, got. And we had to wait for the availability of lots and lots and lots of data to train these systems. And it's exactly what the internet and social media have provided.
I guess where this leads in terms of a question to you is, you know, artificial intelligence, of course, it's on everyone's minds and lips at the moment. No matter where, you know, what as an individual person you do for a living, or, you know, how your view of the world. And I think a lot of people do see it as an existential question mark rather than an existential threat, perhaps. But I was astonished in particular to hear you mention when we last chatted that actually AI is causing or enabling so many incredible breakthroughs, including in the ability in, I think you said, 3 to 5 years to maybe converse with elephants for as one species.
I am optimistic that we're going to have conversations. Some people, not necessarily us ourselves, but some people are going to be able to have conversations with elephants pretty soon. I suspect that elephants will probably not be the first animals that some people have conversations with. The relevant similar research with dolphins is a little further along. It's in some ways a little bit easier to work with them on this stuff. We work with elephants, as you haven't mentioned yet. We run experiments with a group of elephants in Limpopo.
Yes.
So I'm speaking from experience when I talk about the nature of communicating with elephants, which is something we're doing. But to come back to your main thread of your question, without these large models, without these big AI models that are ultimately pattern searchers, pattern seekers, that is, what they do is they work through big data sets. And they discover for themselves, and then, of course, they can report to us, they discover statistical patterns in those data that we could not find on the basis of a prior theory. And just even rolling out our good Bayesian methods, we would be unlikely to find those patterns. And that meant that without this technology, it was quite unlikely that humans would ever be in a position to have a conversation with any non-human animals. And the reason for that is a non-human animal is not going to categorize its experiences. It's not going to categorize the objects and processes in the world in the same way we do. Think about famous episodes of humans decoding secret codes of other humans, like the British decoding the German code at Bletchley Park in World War II, or the Americans decoding the Japanese ciphers that were crucial to winning that war. In both cases, the decoder has crucial leverage on her challenge of decoding from the fact that she knows that the producers of that code she's trying to crack are humans like her. And she has a lot of strong priors. There's my Bayesian talk again. She's got lots of strong priors about what kinds of things they'll be saying to each other, what kinds of things they'll be interested in. And she used, and that leverage is absolutely crucial when she applies a Bayesian method to decode, as she does. With an elephant, that doesn't hold. We can't know in advance what elephants find interesting, except in the most broad and gross terms. You know, of course, they're interested in food and water, and they're interested in their offspring. But we don't know we don't know, as a philosopher would say, we don't know their ontology. We don't know how they actually generally model their world. And that makes human-style decoding pretty close to impossible. But now consider the LLM. The LLM has two massive advantages over a human decoder. First, it doesn't share our ontological biases. So it's not going to have a wrong set of priors going in. It's more open to what it finds than we can be. And secondly, it can simply respond to, it can be sensitive to, because of its sheer size and the sheer volume of data that it can handle, it can be sensitive to statistical relationships that we would simply never find ourselves. So the combination of search power in these systems and their ontological neutrality, the way in which they're not locked into our way of carving up the world, is what provides the leverage for being able to unpack non-human languages.
Yes. Yeah.
And then of course we concentrate on animals where we think their communication systems are highly language-like, are similar in complexity to our language. So that's why, of course, we're the primary focus of investigation are species like dolphins and elephants.
Yes, yeah, extraordinary. I found it quite amazing, and to me, that's one of the positive, shall we say, or potentially positive aspects of where AI might be heading.
It's dangerous. I would like to see a lot more. I fear it's suddenly going to be reported that somebody's in a position to have a conversation with a dolphin or an elephant. And only at that point will we start having a serious conversation about what should we actually converse with them about. Yeah. This amounts to our intrusion in the conscious life world of non-humans. It's going to possibly be very shocking and distressing for them. And we shouldn't just blindly cruise in with no prior care about how we should go about trying to converse with them and what we should say to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, I mean, I think to a lot of people, like, you know, lay people like me, the fundamental structural or architectural problem with the world of the developing world of AI is that we don't, as a global society, seem to have the right people making decisions that impact us all. You know, there are too many tech billionaires in charge who have their own vested interests first and foremost. And I think that's fundamentally distressing. Would you agree, Don?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's no perfect set of people to turn a challenge like this over to. But among all the options, scientists are by far the best ones, not because scientists are more ethical than other people or more careful even than other people. It's just that science is got deeply entrenched institutions for collective responsibility. That is, that is the way in which science institutions work makes it almost impossible for any individual scientist who develops a rogue agenda to be able to just run with it. You've got to convince whole networks of your peers. There's lots of anonymity, so you have to convince people who don't know who you are when you're trying to convince them. And there's a whole infrastructure of responsibility sharing in scientific institutions that we don't have in business or in politics, for that matter. And so, the future of AI and its relationship to society and technology should not be sitting in the hands of a small number of billionaires with very, very idiosyncratic special interests of their own and limited knowledge. I mean, no one person can know enough to be able to take this problem into their own hands. But one fears that Elon Musk is busy trying to do that. And then the other problem, of course, that it makes it hard to be very optimistic about where this is going to go is that now we have an arms race in AI for use in military and other security-related technologies between the U.S. and China. And of course, Europe wants to be competitive in that too. Well, arms races, unfortunately, as we know from every past example, cause people to act in very, very risk-loving ways. Because of course, what you're mainly worried about, what every side is mainly worried about, is losing a march to the other side. So everybody starts trying to speed things up and go faster and faster and faster and take the guardrails off. And so there's where you get, I mean, the theme of our book, there's where you get people collectively acting as if they all love risk, even though most individual people are actually averse to risk, as we know from running experiments with 40,000 of them all over the world. So yeah, it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Where AI
Especially when you sort of cross-pollinate the AI risk with climate change risks. I mean, there was another unbelievable statistic which came through in your book. I think that, and I think you touched upon it earlier in our chat. By the year 2100, there's a 5 to 20% probability that the world's temperature will rise by 6 degrees. Did I get that more or less right? Which is just, yeah, staggering in terms of what that means, you know, for the planet.
Well, that's a tail probability. So let me be very clear to listeners, that's not what we're predicting. Yes. We're just making the point that tail probability is remarkably high. And of course, 6 degrees is catastrophe. 6 degrees, most of the world is uninhabitable. And humans would be down to a few residual populations in a few scattered bits of the world. So I doubt that industrial civilization as we have it now could survive a 4-degree increase. We've already blown through any hope of keeping it down to 2. So, you know, we're in the 2 to 4 zone probably now already. So, you know, that's why the risk is so great.
So, Don, I guess that's it's a relatively pessimistic way to end the conversation. But I think what comes through very strongly in The Gambling Animal is that scientists, economists, academics like yourself and your colleagues, their voice is so critical in helping the broader global society to come to terms with these critical issues. As I said earlier, not just for our own civilization, but for our fellow species. And I would suggest that an overarching challenge to academics like you, and credit to you on the score, is that what you've done is you try to bring the voices of critical thinkers like yourselves into a broader public to pass the language more accessibly, if I can sort of say. So yeah, again, I'd just like to say thank you for a fascinating book, a very important one. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, Don. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your careful questions, Dave, and for thinking so hard about the issues in our book. The reasons that you just described as the point of the book is very much what was in our minds, right?
That's, right.
We're funded publicly in the end of the day, scientists are, and we need to come back to the public with reports that the public can follow. That's the whole point of the enterprise in the end of the day.
Yep. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.